It's 7:08 in the morning, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Yuhas.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. And as you just heard, the breaking news this morning is out of the Supreme Court. There has just been a decision in the Janus versus AFSCME case. It went against organized labor. The substance of the decision appears to be that public sector unions, which currently represent some 5 million workers in the United States of America, will no longer have the ability to make workers who they represent pay fees to cover the cost of that representation. This happened just minutes ago. The dissents are still being read from the bench. We do not have our hands on a copy of the actual written decision. So we're going to hit the pause button on bringing you reaction. We will have a full panel talking about the legal and organizing consequences just after 8 o'clock news headlines here on Upfront. We're going to start this morning by chewing over some of the more consequential decisions that have come out of the Supreme Court, but not grabbed national headlines over the course of the past week. There's been a series of cases that had to do with the process of gerrymandering, and another one that specifically attacks a law that the state of California tried to impose on otherwise unregulated clinics masquerading as reproductive services providers. We're joined in studio by Amani Gandhi. She is a senior legal analyst for WeWire.news, host of the Boom Lawyer podcast, and I should say in that capacity, she has co-hosted an entire tribute podcast to Sonia Sotomayor.
I have indeed. Good
Thanks
morning,
for coming
Brian.
In.
Thanks for having me.
Actually, let's start with the gerrymandering, because that was a total of 3 decisions that came out of the court this session?
Yeah, there were 3 decisions. And then I believe last night a federal district court just threw out Virginia's maps as well. So we seem to have a situation where everyone seems to agree that these maps are racially biased, but the Supreme Court seems unwilling to do anything about it. And the Supreme Court has already said, they said in a 2015 case, that this sort of racial gerrymandering is against our democratic principles, but it yet hasn't figured out what to do about it. So,
first question. Why did the Supreme Court take 3 cases if they were going to punt on them all?
That's a good question. I think that all of the cases came up about the same time. And then when the court kicked back Gill v. Whitford, which was the Wisconsin case, then all of the other cases, it kicked back with instructions to read its opinion in Gill v. Whitford and then rule accordingly. So it's unclear sometimes why the court does the things that it does, but it is alarming that we seem to have a court that is probably the most conservative in decades. And frankly, if they haven't taken up racial gerrymandering yet, it means they haven't said that it's okay yet. I mean, that's the way that I look at it, mm-hmm. frankly.
Practical consequences. All they have done is upheld a decision ruling 1 congressional district in Texas is an illegal gerrymander?
That's correct. All of the districts in Wisconsin were fine. They kicked back North Carolina. They refused to take the North Carolina case. There was a case about North Carolina gerrymandering where a lower court said that the maps were drew with the intent to discriminate against brown and black voters, and the court kicked that case back as well. So yes, right now what we have is 1 district in Texas that was they drew illegal maps for, and the rest, it's just sort of the wild, wild west for brown and black voters.
So the gerrymanders that they're leaving in place, what kind of consequences might they have in this fall's midterm election?
The consequences that they were intended to have, which is to dilute Democratic votes. And diluting Democratic votes essentially means diluting black and brown votes. The interesting, I think, question that's going to come up is whether or not partisan gerrymandering can be sort of a fill-in for racial gerrymandering, right? So what's been happening is that you have Republicans in these states, in Texas and in North Carolina, who are flat-out admitting that they are gerrymandering. And Maryland, the Democrats did it. So they're flat-out admitting that they're gerrymandering in order to gain partisan advantage. And they're saying, we're not doing it based on race, because they know they're not allowed to do it based on race. But the fact of the matter is that brown and black voters tend to vote for Democrats. And so by gerrymandering the districts in such a way that they're packing brown and black voters in certain districts and then spreading brown and black voters throughout other districts so that white Republicans still maintain the majority in those districts. It's a way to make sure that Latino and black voters, well, Latino in Texas and black voters primarily in North Carolina and Virginia, that they don't have the power to participate in the political process. And that's a violation of the Constitution. It's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. It's it's a violation of Articles 1 and 2, I believe. Those are the articles of the Constitution that deal with proportional representation. And it's unfair. I mean, it's really unfair. You have whole swaths of people that are in these really oddly drawn districts that are drawn that way specifically to dilute their voting power.
So this is the literal legal argument is, yes, we're disenfranchising voters of color. It's not because they're voters of color. It's because they're Democrats and therefore happen to be voters of color.
Yes.
Which is kind of breathtaking, but apparently what has at least nominally held the Supreme Court back up to this point is they don't want to come up with a test for what constitutes a legally drawn district line.
Right. That's the problem. I mean, I think the court understands that these wacky maps that are being drawn in districts around the country are wrong, and they're diluting the votes of people who should be allowed to decide whether or not they have representation, right? But they don't know how to create a test that will uniformly decide whether a map is illegal or not. So they keep sort of taking cases and then throwing them back to lower courts and kind of hoping that the lower courts are going to come up with something, and then the appellate courts will uphold something, and then they won't really have to do a whole lot. But the problem is that, you know, Democrats are kind of running out of chances to win elections. The way that the GOP is operating is that they are very strategically targeting Black and brown voters, voters of color, in order to make them unable to participate in the process, because they know that their demographic shifts that are happening that are making it impossible for Republicans to win in some places. Their policies are garbage. And so just the very fact of the fact that the Republicans are enjoying waning support and that there are demographic shifts that mean that the Democrats have a better opportunity to win the votes of Black and brown people because there are more brown people. I mean, the Latinx population is booming, right? And to the extent that a majority of those people are going to be Democrats, I think that's where we're getting so much of the immigration panic from as well. Because the browner this country becomes, the less white this country becomes, and the less popular Republicans become.
Are there federal laws that say what a congressional district should or should not look like?
That is a good question, and election law is not my specialty, so I'm actually not sure. But what I do know is that the Supreme Court has recognized that gerrymandering is a problem. It just hasn't figured out what to do about it. And so a lot of these illegal maps are going to be in place for the November elections. And I mean, the November election is kind of our last chance, I believe, to stem the tide of nonsense that's going on, especially with respect to the courts, with respect to the federal judiciary, because Donald Trump is packing the courts with really regressive, ultra-right-wing candidates in such a way that it makes it really impossible for voters of color to be heard.
Yeah.
It makes it impossible for people who hold these positions. He's packing the courts with white conservatives, right? And so white conservatives tend to not be that concerned about the issues of Black and brown people. So it's the rightward shift of the courts is very alarming, and it's something that I just keep yelling about as much and as loudly as I can. And I hope that I'm making a difference to the however many people happen to listen to me on Twitter, but it's very, very concerning to me because we're already at a place where we have a 5-4 court. I mean, Kennedy might as well be conservative now. He has sided with the conservatives in almost every decision that was of importance to liberals this term. You know, I kind of want to keep him around because he's sometimes a decent, reliable vote on abortion rights, but sometimes he's not. The alternative is Trump puts another Republican conservative on the court, and then we're really in trouble.
I heard they're actually growing a clone of Samuel Alito in a laboratory for just that occasion.
God. I hope not.
We're speaking to Imani Gandhi. She's a senior legal analyst for Rewire.news, also host of the Boom Lawyered podcast. I want to move on to reproductive rights as they were addressed by the Supreme Court, because this is a case whose significance got kind of swallowed by the disposition of Muslim ban version 3.0 yesterday. It was called NIFLA versus Becerra, Becerra being our attorney general here in the state of California. Can you kind of lay out the underlying controversy?
Sure. So NIFLA stands for the National Institutes of Family Life Advocates, and they brought a challenge to a law in California called the Reproductive Fact Act. And that's a law that it was essentially a disclosure requirement law. It required two things. It required covered clinics, pregnancy-related clinics, to post a notice in their offices that California offers a full range of comprehensive family planning services for low-income people at either no cost or very low cost. So you post a notice saying, if you're low-income or you can't afford such and such services, you can call this number and you can get all these family planning services, including contraception and abortion. The second disclosure requirement required clinics that were not licensed to tell their clientele that they were not licensed. So what you have happening are these crisis pregnancy centers, many of which are not licensed, many of which are not staffed by doctors, but they're rather staffed by anti-choice advocates and activists. They are holding themselves out to be abortion clinics. They're holding themselves out to be comprehensive family planning clinics. You walk in and there are people wearing lab coats and they have stethoscopes and clipboards and they are basically cosplaying as doctors. And they're not giving you actual medical advice because they can't, because they're not licensed, and because they don't want to, because their purpose is not to make sure that you have all of the information you need to determine whether or not you want to continue a pregnancy. Their purpose is to push you into childbirth and push you into adoption and to dissuade you from abortion. And now, in order to dissuade some pregnant people from abortion, they will tell you that your pregnancy is not as far along as it is. So you walk in with a 15-week pregnancy, right? They're going to tell you you're 10 weeks along so that, you know, you think, okay, good, I've got a few weeks in order to decide what I want to do. Well, no, really, you only have about 5 weeks because most states have, because of 20-week abortion bans, right? So you only have a specific amount of time during which to get an abortion. And what these clinics want you to do is to wait until your window of opportunity is closed. Then you can't get abortion. Then it's, okay, let's talk about childbirth or let's talk about adoption. It's a very clear law. It's a very helpful law. It's a law that has to do with consumer protection, right? It's a law that says that women, pregnant people who walk into clinics should know where they're going, should know the kinds of services that they're going to expect to get. They should know what kind of services that they're not going to get. And they should know whether or not the people that they are talking to are actual licensed professionals. It seemed to me that it would be an easy case for the Supreme Court to have said, yeah, that's fine. That makes sense. Well, that's not what they did. And the reason that's not what they did is because Clarence Thomas wrote the opinion, all of the conservatives signed on, including Justice Kennedy, who bizarrely wrote a page and a half concurrence touting the value of the First Amendment and likening California's law to an authoritarian, relentless authoritarian regime, which is bizarre given the law that we're talking about, which is just a simple disclosure law. But here's the real hypocrisy of what happened yesterday. So there's a case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, 1992. It's a very famous case. It's the case that developed the undue burden standard, right? So if states want to enact abortion restrictions, they can't enact restrictions that are an undue burden or place a substantial obstacle in the way of a person exercising their right to choose. So at issue in that case, one of the laws at issue was a Pennsylvania law that required all of these disclosures, these state-mandated disclosures. Part of those disclosures were about the state trying to dissuade women from having abortions, right? So they would talk to you about adoption. They would talk to you about the sort of financial assistance that would be available after you gave birth to the child. Those disclosures, as part of Pennsylvania's informed, quote-unquote, informed consent regime, were deemed perfectly fine. They were challenged under the First Amendment by doctors who said, we don't want to be forced to read a state message to our patients if we don't agree with that message, right? And in some states, that message includes telling pregnant people that they're going to get breast cancer if they have an abortion, telling pregnant people they're going to have suicide ideation, pregnant women are going to become drug addicted, and all of these horrible things.
Which are all false.
None of these things are true. But the Supreme Court has said it's okay to force doctors to say these things. But when it comes to telling non-doctors to tell their patients, their clientele, that they're not doctors and that they don't offer these services, suddenly that's a First Amendment problem.
So did the Supreme Court bother to explain the distinction? Is there some argument that one is just telling doctors to lie, which is okay, and the other is telling potentially unlicensed clinic operators to violate their religious beliefs?
No, they didn't actually talk about religious beliefs. I mean, they didn't talk. It's obviously this is a religious beliefs issue. But what Thomas did, and what I think a lot of conservatives think, is that abortion isn't healthcare. Abortion is more of a cultural issue than it is a healthcare issue. So people have these moral oppositions, whether they're religious or spiritual or whatever, they have these moral opposition to abortion. And so it's different. It's a different it's a different beast. It's a different animal. And so we can add these regulations and regulate the heck out of abortion in a way that we're not going to do for other areas of medicine or any other professional licensing rubrics, right? The issue is whether or not you can require people who are either licensed or people who should have a license to disclose certain things. So, for example, you know, when attorneys, you see attorneys that are advertising their services, there are laws that say, that require attorneys to say certain things in their advertises. Like, if you are going to advertise that you got a $5.2 million settlement for someone, you have to say those sorts of results aren't typical, so that you're not tricking people into thinking if they come to see you, they're going to get a $5.2 million settlement for their personal injury. So we do require professionals to say things that they might not otherwise want to say. And we don't say that that's a First Amendment issue because you can regulate professional speech in a way that you can't regulate political speech. And the problem is that anything having to do with abortion is automatically seen as political speech. And so if you are in any way encouraging people or suggesting to people that abortion might be an option for them, that is automatically political speech. And so the way in which Clarence Thomas tried to get around the Casey problem is by saying, well, what we were doing with Casey is saying that the doctors have to say all of these things because it's in connection with medical practice. And so he really gives away the game there because he's saying that abortion care and the information that you're giving about abortion is somehow not medical practice. And what's really, I mean, that's just absurd, right? We know that that's absurd. Justice Stephen Breyer, who wrote a really amazing dissent, and I feel like Stephen Breyer doesn't get as much love as he should. He wrote this amazing dissent, and really, at one point, he just said to Thomas, really? Question mark? And it's a beautiful thing, because really? Question mark?
Were there any emojis in the decision?
There were no emojis in the decision, but I think if he could have put maybe a middle finger emoji, he might have. Stephen Breyer's a rather temperate dude, but, you know, when he gets angry, he sort of expresses it in data. He's a very kind of nerdy professorial justice. So he just went through all of the precedent, all of the case law, and just dismantled everything that Thomas said. So that after you read Stephen Breyer's opinion and you go back and read Justice Thomas's, you realize Justice Thomas's opinion makes literally no sense. And I'm not saying that because I don't like Thomas. I don't like his jurisprudence. I think that he's harmful, particularly for low-income people and Black people. His opinion literally doesn't make sense. There are often times when Supreme Court justices disagree about the interpretation of a statute, and I can say, yeah, I can see how Alito would have come down that way or Thomas would have come down that way, but ultimately my liberal progressive politics leads me to approach this issue in this way. This wasn't that. This was just flat out, let me try to find a way to ensure that pregnant people in California don't get the information that they need and continue to be deceived. He even said at one point that when California said that pregnant people were being deceived by these clinics, Thomas referred that as purely hypothetical, which is nonsense, because it's just common sense that if you go into a pregnancy clinic, a crisis pregnancy clinic, and they are cosplaying as doctors, you're going to be deceived, especially if you are part of the vulnerable population that this law was meant to focus on, which is low-income people, people who don't have a lot of time to do a lot of Googling on the internet to figure out which clinic is actually a Planned Parenthood clinic and which clinic is called, you know, Parents for Progress, and as you know, it's PP, but it's really a crisis pregnancy center. So you go in and you think you're going to Planned Parenthood, but you're really not. They're actually relying on the inability, that the lack of time that certain vulnerable populations have to research and figure out what's going on. They're relying on that in order to deceive them. And the Supreme Court has just said, it's okay, you can go ahead and continue to deceive these people.
So in terms of like downstream impacts, is this a case of abortion has now been completely moved into this separate area of law where it's treated as political speech? Or is this a case of there's this compelled speech argument gaining traction in the Supreme Court that can be used to challenge any regulation?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I think that there has been an ongoing effort to remove abortion from healthcare. I mean, people will say, well, abortion's not healthcare, it's baby murder, you know, stuff like that. And I think that the Supreme Court, although I don't think the Supreme Court would ever outright say that, you know, abortion is murder, but they do often recognize that there are people who do believe that way. And so they sort of give credence to both sides of the argument. And because it's such a touchy issue, they have taken it outside the rubric of healthcare. And they're doing the same thing to contraception, by the way, because a lot of these
that was the point of Hobby Lobby, right?
Exactly. That was the point of Hobby Lobby. It is to say that certain people, certain organizations may think that contraception is an abortifacient, is that contraception is the same as abortion. And even though that's patently not true, they sincerely believe it in their religious hearts. And so we have to give credence to their absolutely wrong, unscientific beliefs and then use those absolutely wrong, unscientific beliefs to strip rights away from women and pregnant people.
Are there other legal recourse now after this ruling at the state level?
What I'm hoping that will happen is that California is going to go back to the drawing board and is going to craft an even narrower law that hopefully will pass Supreme Court muster. But, you know, this law was about as narrow as it got. I mean, the law, there have been other laws and ordinances in other states and municipalities that have tried to address the CPC deception problem by requiring CPCs to actually say with their mouths, you know, the staff workers, we don't offer abortion, you can go here for abortion. And that has been deemed to be compelled speech. But the California law didn't require the clinic workers to say anything at all. It just required a notice to be posted, kind of like I'm sure in your break room here, you have a notice about OSHA or about workmen's compensation. You know, it's just very particular things that workers, people need to know. It's not political speech. There's the sign in your break room that talks about OSHA isn't a position, a political opinion about OSHA. It's just telling people what their rights are. And so when it comes to abortion, there seems to be this overwhelming movement that pregnant people don't have the right to know about abortion, about their reproductive options, because it is political, it is intertwined with religion, and it's icky.
Monica Andy, icky is the note we'll end on. Thank you so
perfect.
Much for coming in.
Thank you for having
Thank
me.
Thank you.
Monica Andy is a senior legal analyst for Rewire.News. She's host of their Boom Lawyered podcast. They put out an emergency pod yesterday to react to what came out of the Supreme Court. Again, if you're just joining us, the Supreme Court has just decided a landmark case for organized labor and against organized labor in Janus versus AFSCME. We're just starting to go through the decision. We have a full panel lined up for reaction to talk about both what it means in terms of law and what it means in terms of organizing strategy for unions in this country. That'll be just after 8 o'clock news headlines. Right now, it is 7:31. What do we have coming up next?
Coming up next, we have Casey Siegel, who's director of the Climate Law Institute of the Center for Biological Diversity, and Supervisor Catherine Sears of Marin County, to talk about a Monday ruling by a federal district court in San Francisco that threw out San Francisco and Oakland's landmark climate change lawsuits against big oil.
This is a very lawyer-heavy broadcast today.
It's an important day for the law.
That's all coming up next.